Welcome to Combox. Jared here doing the Wagon Wheel, which is the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket. If you want to support us on YouTube Super Chats while we're going, you can. Thank you very much. And we'll try and answer those at the end. But if you're never sure what time we're going to record, and I'm never sure what time we're going to record this show, and you want to make sure your question is asked, the best way to do that is always via Patreon. You can go to Good Areas Podcast there and you can ask a question early like PJ has. And he said, unpopular opinion, if Lala Modi was still in charge of the IPL and was also in charge of the ICC while having free reign of both, world cricket would be in a lot better place. The establishment hates visionaries. Discuss. Better, I think, he's doing a lot of work here, PJ. It would be in a much different place. I think financially, it would probably have made a lot more money. I think that Lala is the sort of person that will happily throw things out that he doesn't care about in order to chase things he does care about, which are generally power and his own status. So I think a lot of things would have gone wrong with cricket. There are things I think it would have done better, which is working out how to make, you know, America, China, Japan work, right? You know, even Europe perhaps, because I think he would look at that and just be like, well, we only need two or three of them to pick up and the rights are going to go through the roof and that changes everything. He's certainly a long way ahead on understanding American sports. And I think ICC at some times, you know, cricket's done some incredible things. It was ahead of the game for a long time. And then a lot of the other sports cultures from around the world went past it. But think about all the other issues that he would bring in. There's no due diligence. You know, people are upset about Jay Shah. Well, who wrote that template? It was Lalit Modi. And Lalit would do it at a much higher level than Jay Shah ever would. There was open corruption in the way that the IPL was set up. I don't think anyone doubts that anymore, if they ever did doubt it. So there would be much more corruption within cricket. And it's not like cricket is struggling for corruption, but I actually think that in that situation, Lalit, what's the thing he always says? He says something along the lines of, like, yes, I break rules and bend things and everything, but I make everyone money. That isn't quite the job of running the ICC. The IPL is a little bit different, of course. I think the IPL would be in a much better situation as a sport. Whether it would be in a much better situation as an administration, I don't know. And the ICC, I don't think you want someone like Lalit Modi in charge of the ICC ever. Reece says, are cricket fans eternally nostalgic? Are all people nostalgic? I mean, this is one of the funniest things in the world is, you know, so you've got the Make America Great Again as a slogan. And, you know, many different countries have these kinds of things before, you know, bring back British values or whatever it may be, all these sorts of things. And you're like, well, what, when you ask them to tell you when the good period was, they can't. Most people like movies and music from the period where they're what, 15 to 25? When they probably had the most time to watch them and got to watch what they wanted without their parents interfering or whatever that may be. We are bred to be that way. So I'm not sure that cricket fans are more nostalgic than, say, football fans or any other sports fan. I find myself watching the IPL and yearning for a simpler time. I know it's always been a capitalistic monster, but it's on a different level than ever before. So the capitalistic thing, it's really worth remembering that, like, cricket only exists because it has made money, Reece. And England went out of its way to pretend that wasn't the case because they didn't want to pay the players. But it's always only existed because it has made money. We had franchise cricket. I don't even know if you'd call it franchise cricket, but we had a version of franchise cricket around in the 1850s, for instance. We had novelty cricket in the late 1800s. One of the reasons that cricket got so big as a sport was, you know, the fact that they had a unified laws that was written, which was there for gambling. Victor Trumper essentially went on strike. The original Australian team, not the Indigenous team, they were slightly different, but the original Australian test team that came over as a collective to make money. That was the whole point, that they all put in a little bit of money that they'd made from playing cricket. Then they came over here so they could make more money. There was probably a time when that was better hidden. But if you go back and you read some of the stuff that the judges are saying in the Kerry Packer cases, it's fascinating. They don't paint Kerry Packer as a saint or anything, but they keep saying to the administrators, you could have paid them, the players, and you didn't want to, right? We're in a position now where that has flipped quite a lot. And what you could argue is realistically, we went from more of a socialist form of cricket to more of a capitalist form of cricket, probably, you know, after the rest of the world had done a similar thing. Overall, socialism is generally going to be better than capitalism, which doesn't care about anything other than, you know, the bottom line, right? Like, there is no sort of unifying good part of that. And socialism is obviously going to do a lot of things, but socialism moves really slow and gets has as many problems with corruptions and other things that hang on to it. We're in a position now, Reese, where a kid from Nepal can bowl 5 or 6 good deliveries on YouTube and change his life. We're in a position now where a woman from, you know, South America can bowl a, you know, a few good spells. Someone hears about it, passes on to someone else, and she ends up playing in a league and becoming a professional cricketer. That wasn't happening before. Are there negatives about all this? Of course, right? Like, there are billionaires everywhere. We've gone from being run by really stodgy administrators who just mostly wanted to give free tickets to people and tell everyone how great they were, to being run by billionaires who also don't care, but in a completely different way. But the people who play the sport have an ability to make money in a way that they just didn't before. You know, I'm trying to remember that there's a really good one about golf and the Marsh brothers. So Rod Marsh and his brother, oh my God, I'm going to forget his name. Rod Marsh, the cricketer, the Australian vice captain, brother, what's his brother's name? I should know this. Graham Marsh. So Graham Marsh was a very, very good golfer. But I think you could argue that over the entirety of their career, Rod Marsh probably has a better career. You know, both of them, world-class athletes, two different sports. You know, you have to respect the, you know, the talent they both had. But one goes to golf, one goes to cricket. Graham Marsh is making so much more money than Rod Marsh. When Rod Marsh is the vice captain of the best team in the world, is an early pioneer in sort of T20, ODI hitting and everything else. You know, certainly one of the best people in the world at what he does. And Graham Marsh is clearly a step down and is making like 5, 10, 20 times the money, right? That doesn't make any sense, Reese, that our sport wasn't paying the people who were putting their bodies on the line. I know so many older cricketers who can't walk at the end of their career. So yes, things have changed. Yes, it's never going back. This is why conservatism and, you know, all these movements are all destined to fail. You can't put it back in. Once it changes, it changes. There isn't anything going back, right? Those things don't work. It's impossible to do, because even if you try and bring in, like, what could you even do now? How would you get the money out of cricket that it's in there? Because what would happen now is if somehow, let's say the ICC and all the cricket boards got together and went, let's just get rid of all these owners, let's get rid of all these leagues, someone would just do it on their own. You can't go back to something else. So things are lost all the time from older cricket, right? There's some great things. 8 ball overs. He's probably a very, very good one, right? Not wearing helmets so you could see the players' faces a little bit better. You know, there were lots of great things about cricket that have changed, but other great things are coming as well. Grim says, if you were to start a franchise today and you had to pick of all players, who would you pick? I would love to see something similar to Bill Simmons' NBA trade value rank in the IPL. International cricket. I don't know if you've seen, Grim, but we actually do trades. Me and Varun have done 2, 3, 4 podcasts about trading international players, which is lots of fun. When do you think we'll get to the point where ball by ball data is available without a commercial license? So ball by ball data is already available commercially, Grim. There is a version of that out there at the moment you can find via Crick Sheets, which is completely free to everyone. The thing that is not free at the moment is things like shot type, you know, delivery type, and all the Hawkeye data. But a lot of the other stuff is out there. But yeah, there is obviously a big white space when it comes to advanced data and everything else. We will be having a version of like Basketball Reference, Baseball Reference on Combox that will probably have one of the more advanced statistical places to be in cricket. Well, it will be the most advanced one. Almost instantly, just because there isn't that much out there. But yeah, the Hawkeye data, I don't think will ever be a part of that. Oh, no, actually, I shouldn't say it will never be a part of that. I don't think the Oracle data will specifically be a main part of that. So there's always going to be a holdout. And also, do IPL teams have large non-broadcast revenues? Would it make sense for a team to retain even a non-performing marquee player just for their brand value for TV ads and such? I don't think so at the moment, unless it is, I suppose, Dhoni. Maybe Coley in the next generation could be the other one. But those guys, I don't even know how it works. But no, at the moment, the vast majority of the money comes from the broadcasting deals. We're not they're not really monetizing the rest of the franchises in the way that they probably will do over the next 20 to 30 years. Manon says, how do you think Jaspal feels about potentially being the greatest since Bradman? How do you balance that alongside something like just wanting to be picked in other formats? Yeah, look, it's a fascinating one. He seems to me to be more in that sort of Steve Smith kind of thing than I would say in that sort of Michael Clark, Virat Kohli side of things. I think there are some players who are very much driven by where they will end up in history. Based on the bits I've seen of Jaiswal so far, he seems to be a bit more like, yeah, like I said, Sachin, Smith, those sorts of guys that are driven by their next ball, right? So everyone's driven by a different thing, right? And I think that, you know, sort of legacy and impact means something to some players, and it doesn't mean something to other players. So I think the people who don't, I always thought that it kind of crushed Michael Clark. This whole idea that he never wanted to be dropped, which I thought was his first mistake. This whole idea that he wanted to be the next legend rather than just making sure he was the best batter he could be. And when that sort of, his life changed when he got older, he just becomes a really good player, right? Like he does, you know, he's probably an Australian great. He's not maybe not an all-time great batter, but he's not far off that argument either. And he probably had the ability to do that all the way. Whereas with someone like Virat, I'm trying to think of someone else, like, you know, along those lines where I think it really matters to them, right? I think that's a harder pressure. But I think in Virat's case, it probably did produce the Virat Kohli that we see, right? And I think for Jaiswal, he feels like much more of that sort of Smith, Boycott, Chandrapal, Tendulkar, where it's like the actually most important thing to those guys is probably just the next delivery. If, you know, it's one of the things we talked about quite a lot in the book is that players are really vastly differently motivated from each other, right? When it's about the next ball, I don't know. Like, the only time we're going to know if Jaiswal feels the pressure is if, I don't know, let's say he's averaging 63 and he's 60 tests in. And then just the hype machine becomes a big thing. But at the moment, his record's a bit more realistic, right? So hopefully he can just go on and bat. Hurt says, I like your team maps using radar charts. Will the same method work for representing a batter's stats across scoring phases and various bowling types? If not, is there a better way? Yes. So we'll definitely, I'm trying to think if we have radar charts for individual players at the moment. No, I don't think the only one I could think of, Hurts, that we used is we did a more subjective thing. So it wasn't as numbers dependent, but we did a very subjective thing where we went through and we did, we looked at Glenn McGrath for every different skill set he had and gave him a rating more like a video game. I don't know if visually that worked perfectly, but that the idea again was, you know, showing all the different ratings he had for all the different skill sets that he had available to him. Yeah, I think there is some things that we will be doing for players. I'm trying to remember what the plan was for the stats for individual players. But what we really wanted to do is, I mean, I love trolling Stats Guru and, you know, Basketball Reference and those sorts of places. But I understand that the general fan doesn't. So what we've really been trying to do is work out a way for when we do it with Combox to make it a lot more visual so that you can see very, very instantly. I'm trying to remember who the company was. Intelligent Cricket, which I think is an offshoot of Decimal that Rob works for. Intelligent Cricket at one stage, they had a very, like a commentator's dashboard. And there's a couple of NBA sites that I've looked at as well, which again, are just a little bit more visual. And I'm like, I think that makes a lot more sense for, you know, those people who just don't like trolling through numbers. Trying to make things more visual is something that we do all the time. None of us work in those fields. Like we're just doing it and trying to make it work for fans. So sometimes we put something up that works really well, and many times we don't. Satchmo says, what position would Sobers bat in an all-time West Indies T2011? Would six be too low? Yeah, he wouldn't need to bat at six, would he? He might be a three. I think his record against spin is pretty... I don't know if I have his overall record, but certainly his ability to attack spin... He does have a decent record batting at three in Test cricket. I know he doesn't do it all that much. But he does have a pretty decent record. Yeah, he averages 75 in Asia. I know it's only from 11 tests. What is that? He averages 99 in India and 32 in three tests in Pakistan. Yeah, I would probably bat him at three so that he can come in at the end of the power play and hit a couple of boundaries if you need. And then he would just go after the spinners. And then if he stays in, you know, you're probably going to win the game at the end. I'm trying to think, because I think in T20 cricket, Viv would open. And then Lara's probably the four. You probably have a Greenidge above them. It causes a bit of an issue of where you would put Headley. It became a crick picks. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Reece says, when you're interviewing the older players, ones from the 50s, 60s, for All Out Cricket, how did you go about it? Was it a case that this is the concept for the book, or what are your thoughts? Or was it specifics about specific batters and players? Every interview I go into, I have a different kind of thought process of what I am trying to get out of it. So, you know, I've just started doing some interviews for the Kohli book, right? So every individual is a different interview for me. The older players I talked to, I think specifically what I went in was I tried to find the players that overlapped with their eras, right? And said, okay, so this is what I know about this player. What are your thoughts? And they'd be like, that's right, that's wrong. This is right. Actually, I never saw that. And then you would sort of allow them to discuss that player and then try and drill down on a few specific things that I knew would need to be in, that I needed to know about this player. So you kind of allow them to do that for each player, and you can tell really early on if they have a thought on the player or not. So I really struggled to find anyone who had really strong views on Ken Barrington either way, which was a bit of a pain because he was one I really wanted to drill down on. And I found it very hard to get to that level on someone like Barrington. I caught a couple of the other players, Peter May was one, and there was a feeling that as good as Peter May was, he probably wasn't at the level of some of the other guys. And that was a helpful thing to learn from some of the older players. And then you kind of chipping away, and then you're looking at, do they have stories about these players? Is there a reason they thought this player was good? Sometimes when you're interviewing players like older players like that, you might throw out something that's, I don't want to say is wrong, but you know is probably not going, they're not going to enjoy it, to get them to kind of correct you because you want them to use the phrasing in the way that you want to do it. So it's very much, I'm trying to think of the two oldest players that I talked to. I went in with a very specific set of players that I needed them to talk about. Then the next generation was probably Bumble and Chappell. So again, very specific players. These are the players that I need to know more about that I don't think I fully understand. So Roy Fredericks was a really good one that I wanted, Ian Chappell to talk about. Bob Simpson was one that I really wanted. I knew that Bumble had had a relationship with Bob Simpson, so I really wanted to know as much about it. So, I'm pushing them in that direction to see what comes from it. And then if they don't give me exactly what I want, I'll find a way to kind of rephrase it, right? And do that. But generally, when you're talking to an old batter, and we haven't started the bowling book yet, but when you're talking to an old batter, what they're really looking for is, like, they don't get a chance to talk about those kinds of things that often. So, you know, once I got into the specifics and things about, you know, where did they hit the ball and, you know, how did they think about batting and everything, and did they help you with your game? These guys just completely open up, especially on the players from their own sides. You know, like, you know, learning about Sobers and Hutton from guys who batted at the other end was just incredible. James says, there's a lot of talk in the media about either Smith or Roo opening and the other keeping at seven. Do you have any insight as to whether that's just media speculation or whether it's actually how England are thinking? No, I haven't really been on the scene this year. I mean, you know, the early English summers, quite often now, not every year, but the last few years, I've been doing the IPL, right? So I haven't even been at a ground to chat to anyone at the moment. I've heard the same thing. I'd find it odd if Smith started opening, but I suppose there's a possibility. Alex says, is Suryavanshi going to dominate international cricket in years to come? Have Surrey already lined up a county deal for him? Don't think so. Well, maybe the Surrey can afford him with the Ambanis now. I don't know. The only hesitation I have is I need to see him in more formats, right? His hitting skill is incredible. His ability to hit very full balls that are very good, very hard, seems like an absolute outlier skill that I don't think I've seen from anyone else as consistently. Like the sort of, I've seen people who can do it, but you know they're going to miss the odd one. And it feels like from him, that's not the case. I thought it was really interesting in the day when, I think it was Mohsin Khan, got had a little bit out of the wicket and got him for a wicket maiden. I thought that was a really interesting little data point. I just don't think we know enough about him at the moment. I just want to see more. But yeah, the hand-eye coordination, the ability to, like, it must be very hard to just bowl your best ball to him if you're a bowler at the moment. And that should translate to all three formats, I would have thought. I want to see him more against, you know, the short ball. I still think, like a lot of these young players, he struggles when the ball's really, really wide to him. You know, there's a lot of issues there. The more we know about him, I find it hard to think he would ever not be a fantastic player. Whether he's just going to absolutely become the new Bradman that's just really hard to tell right at the moment. Aravind says, say you develop 160 kilometer bowler in a lab, and then you get them to add just one more high-level skill to that player, like accuracy, a slow ball, or even unorthodoxy in action. What would that be? And would it be the same regardless of format? So I think if I'd answered this question a couple of years ago, I would have said lateral movement. I'm wondering now if it's not just accuracy, but it's probably those are the two things that would be at the top of my list, right? You know, bowling at that speed is obviously absolutely incredible, but if you can't put it in the right area anymore, I still think people are going to hit you because of bowling machines, because of wangers, because of throwdowns, you know, all these different things now. People are actually much more used to the ball just coming at them at that speed. You see it in associate cricket, right? It used to be anyone bowled over 80 miles an hour in associate cricket would just clean up. That's not the case anymore. So everyone's getting more used to this. I wonder what happens though if you're 160 kilometers an hour and you can get lateral movement, but without accuracy. I think that's the best version. The unorthodoxy thing is also interesting. PJ says, the passing of the torch. Do commentators and the press refer to an up-and-coming Indian player such as Suryavanshi as the next Sachin or the next Virat or someone else completely? Alternatively, when Sachin was a teenager, who was he compared to? Sunil Gavaskar. Yes. Was Kohli considered the next Sachin, and what was Sunny called? I don't know about Sunny. That's a little bit before my time. Look, I think I haven't heard that many people call, in the media anyway, call Suryavanshi the next Tendulkar. And I think it's partly because he's so different to Tendulkar at the moment. So there's that. You've just had Jaiswal come through as well, right? You've still got Shubman Gill around, guys. Like, there's so much Indian talent that I think it's a little bit more confusing at the moment. I don't think it's a linear thing. I think with Kohli, it made sense to say the next Sachin. His best format is a one-day cricket, which Sachin was absolutely, you know, ridiculous in as well. So I think there was a direct correlation between the two of them there. Both, what, shorts are right-handers as well. So, you know, who play very technically correct but can still hit the ball quite hard. All these sorts of little things. Sirivanchi is a left-hander who currently kind of clears his front leg, and no matter what length you bowl, just hammers it. It's hard to compare him to anyone in cricket, really. At the moment, if you're going to compare Sirivanchi to anyone, it would be a combination of Lance Kaluza and Sachin Tendulkar, right? Like, that's a hybrid. But yeah, I think, you know, when you're doing things like this, it's, you know, one of the easier things is, that's what I found Steve Smith so hard, and probably why I whiffed the biggest on him in my career, is at that stage in my life, I was very much trying to look for things that had happened before, and then was this person repeating that kind of a pattern? I've probably gone out a little bit more on that now, especially in an era where outliers are so important, and, you know, Malinga and Sonnen Ryan, all these different guys. Like, I think I now understand there's more than one way to do it, which I don't think I did when I first got into this job. But I think the natural thing is, like, to compare it to something you've seen before. So, yeah, the media will do versions of that. But, yeah, I don't think Sirivanchi directly correlates to Sachin in that way. Mob says, Wagon Wheel by podcast, Wagon Wheel by question. How useful is the Wagon Wheel as an analytical tool? Is it something you consider at a per innings level, a player's career phase level, or all players at a snapshot level? I think it has its strengths and weaknesses, Wagon Wheel. I think I'd be more interested in it over a season than over a particular game. And what it sometimes, so the thing about the Wagon Wheel is, this is slightly different in this modern T20 era, but right up until the last 5 years of T20 cricket, what a Wagon Wheel actually told you is kind of how the bowlers bowled and where the field was. So that still gives you a really good idea, and it's a really good tool. But if, I think it was Sai Sadarshan the other day, I don't know if it was his 100 or his 80, but I remember one of those innings, they chucked up the Wagon Wheel, and he had basically no balls in front of point or square leg. So I was thinking to myself, well, they must have bowled a little bit shorter to him naturally all the way through, because it would be almost impossible for him to have this pattern if they hadn't done that, right? So there's still certainly an element of that. It's a very limited thing, and I don't even know if there's a way to sort of map it with fielders. Like, it would be really, really tough. But yeah, it's going to give me a very good idea of roughly where a player wants to hit the ball, where they're more comfortable in hitting the ball, how I might have to set the field. I think all those things are still there within it. Abe says, humor me, always. Suppose you have a hypothetical friend who thinks baseball is better than cricket. How would you make the case for cricket being the superior sport? Please don't tell me it's subjective. It can't be. More seriously, how would you pitch cricket to a baseball fan? So cricket is a better sport than baseball, and this is not having to go at baseball, because I've got no issues with baseball as a sport, but it's a better sport fundamentally because it's a 360-degree sport. The ball has to bounce as well. There are just more facets that make it more interesting than baseball. Baseball is a sport that is, if you go to a baseball game in America, it almost lives in it's almost more like a carnival. And, you know, there are chants at certain times of the day, and, you know, things that people, so it just, it doesn't, a lot of baseball is watching a guy miss a ball, right? Or leave a ball, right? Even more than test cricket. And it can be very, I suppose the big difference is it's just much more, you know, one-dimensional. I think baseball is a fantastic sport, and I love the way it's developed, and I wish cricket would have developed in many of the same kinds of ways, just, you know, from a technology point of view and understanding the sport kind of view. Baseball's well ahead of cricket. But baseball's also easier to use Moneyball for, because it's way more simple than cricket, right? Moneyball doesn't work in cricket in the same way it does in baseball, because in baseball, there are absolutes, right? And so for me, checkers is a really good sport, a really good game. But obviously chess is the more interesting one, right? Now, you could make chess. You can make checkers really fun. And, you know, if you had drinking and hot dogs and, you know, ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da and all that sort of stuff, and make it into a cultural thing. America's done brilliantly with the way they've done with baseball. But if you're looking purely as a sport, I just think it's not as it doesn't have as many dimensions as what cricket has. As far as pitching it to a baseball fan in the US, I don't know if that they're the fans I would necessarily go after. I think with there's so many different kinds of American sports fans. I think there is, if you're looking for a sport that is has so many unknowables, I'm not sure if there's a sport that has more than cricket, right? You can be spending the rest of your life learning about it. If you love history, well, my God, American sports and even football has to take a seat to cricket, right? We're talking about building nations. We're talking about political unrest. We're talking about, you know, nuclear weapons. Like, cricket is on a level that, like, even football in the last 30 years is still like, settle down, cricket. You've gone too far here. So you've got, there's two angles straight away that I think are endlessly fascinating. Another one is that it is a sport that encourages you to talk and drink, right? Whether it's alcohol or tea, it doesn't really matter. You sit down and chat. Americans, that seems to be a thing that they like to do with their sports, right? So I think there's lots of different parts of it. And it really depends on what kind of fan that you're talking to and what they're looking for. But yeah. Ellie says, is there a market and enough skillful players for three different formats, sports, if three different bodies were running three different formats? Yeah, I don't have any issue with that. There's what, 4,000 professional cricketers, maybe 5,000 now, in the world. Or does that count the women? Let's go with 4,000. There's 4,000 professional cricketers in the world. There are more than enough professional cricketers to have that. It's obviously going to, are they skillful enough? Well, if you separate all three formats, you're going to be in a situation like that. But I find it hard to believe that in a world where cricket is much bigger than rugby, we have rugby league and rugby union, and we can't have three formats of cricket. There's a lot more people in the world who play and watch cricket than there is rugby. And rugby league and rugby union seem to be doing fine. I mean, I don't know if they're doing fine, but, you know, they've been going for, what, 200 years each and are both worth money? Hayden says, the proposed alternative to the sale of the Big Bash is to decrease fees to bookmakers and open more markets for betting. Is this a sustainable long-term strategy, or is this just boomers not being able to keep up with the rest of the world? Okay, I haven't followed that part of it as much as I should have, Hayden. This feels to me like they just want to sell it, and they're like, well, the only other option is to make money off bookmakers. I think if that's the way you're thinking, then you probably already decided to sell it and you can't come up with anything else. I mean, what could they offer the open? I don't understand how the cricket could make much more money from betting than it already does in Australia. Am I missing something? Like, what do the betting companies need they're already making the money. And perhaps I'm missing something there. As far as advertising directly to a league that is still at least partly aimed at children and families, there's an issue there. I think Australia, and I say this from an outsider's perspective, because I haven't lived there in, you know, almost 20 years or however long it's been, but I feel like Australia is moving more and more towards, can we just stop being obsessed with gambling? Can we stop advertising gambling and everything else? I seem to read a lot of articles about this and you know, people coming up with things. So from my perspective, I would say that doesn't make sense, that move. The other argument here is, what is the Big Bash and what's the purpose of the Big Bash? Why does it need all this extra money? My understanding of the league is it is a profitable league, right? Now, hold my hand up. I haven't gone through that, but it's a profitable league. So what's the issue? Why do you suddenly need more money? Is it to bring in overseas players? That's going to be tough, even if you have IPL owners, right? We've seen that with the ILT, and we even seen it with the SA20. There's only so many big name players. And how many of those big name players actually change things in Australia right at the moment? So I don't really fundamentally understand the desperate need for more money as it currently stands. I'm happy to be, if there's someone from Cricket Australia who wants to reach out and tell me what I'm missing. This reminds me of maybe 10 or 12 years ago. It was around the Big Three kind of issue where I was talking to a board member of a different country and he was saying, Jared, you don't understand. We can't keep up with the top teams. And I said, but you're never going to. And he's like, no, but we need to make more money. And I said, but you can't. Your market is what defines how much money you can make, right? I'm not saying let's say you can, you know, raise profits and you can cut corners and everything else. In what world are you going to be able to, you know, be on a similar level to Australia, England, and India, who just have these huge, wealthy media markets, right? And that's where Australia has found themselves with the Big Bash. So what are they trying to make it into? Is the idea for it to be the second biggest league in the world? Does that make them a lot more money? Does that change the future of Australian cricket in a positive way? I don't really understand what they're trying to do at the moment. They're not going to catch up to the other two markets anyway, I would have thought, unless something changes in Australia. I can't see how they're going to do that. So they're always going to have less money than England and India, right? They might end up having less money than some of the other countries as well when economies change and, you know, in the future and everything else, because Australia's not that big a place. So what is the idea of just going after more money here? Is it actually helping you provide better cricketers? Okay. I need to see the proof of that. And I'm not seeing it at the moment. I'm seeing at the moment that we need more money. It seems that Australian cricket is doing okay for money. So I'm confused by the whole thing. Ian says, I know that you think tactical substitution is a long-term good thing for cricket, as do I. But do you think the county championship is currently proving that no substitutes, concussion aside, is actually a better system than halfway houses? Yeah, I don't like halfway houses. I think I have massive issues with the impact sub, the super sub, the X factor sub or whatever they called it in the Big Bash. I'm a very much Ian when it comes to substitutions, a shit or get off the pot person. It's largely an accident that cricket doesn't have substitutions, right? I think if, I honestly think, and this might sound weird, but if World War II doesn't happen when it happens and we don't have that sort of swing back to the good old days thinking, I think that actually we would have just almost naturally had substitutions in the 1950s anyway. And for whatever reason, it doesn't happen. And then cricket sort of pivots from all the other sports, right? At a time when they were all going towards substitutions. But yeah, what the ECB is doing in county cricket is exactly what I said would happen. It doesn't make any sense. Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. Nathan Astle's world record fastest test double 100 was scored in 2002, well before the advent of the T20 era, and still no one has come within 10 balls of beating it. Is this the new Jessop or Bannerman, or the new batting record that somehow no one can ever beat? And if not, how has no one bested it yet? It will definitely get beaten within the next 10 years. I would assume Jessop will get beaten within the next 10 years. So I think those are slightly different. And I don't know as much about the Jessop one, of course, but I think those are slightly different. You know, we've had a lot of, there are always outliers in records and everything else. But yeah, I can definitely see why those two will get beaten. Bannerman is the one that I'm not sure. I suppose it should happen. I mean, the Bannerman record, if I'm not mistaken, gets beaten a lot in first-class cricket. I almost feel like it's, again, dumb luck that it hasn't happened in Test cricket. What have we had? 2,500 Test matches? Sorry, I've lost all my numbers at the moment. But I think all three of those will be beaten. I think the Bannerman one is the flukiest one just because I think there's a bunch of first-class games where that has happened, and I don't really understand why it hasn't happened in Test match cricket so far. Bannerman, by the way, for those of you who don't know, it's the highest percentage of runs in an innings, which hilariously happens in the first Test and has never been beaten since, by a guy who wasn't even the best player in his family and didn't go on to have a great career himself. Oh, Ajit. This is back when we had Star Cricket before Star Sports, and I was too young to remember the actual program of the analysts, but they're basically talking about all-rounders, mainly in the context of ODIs before T20s. One of the analysts argues that players like Collingwood, Hodge, Dilshan shouldn't be classified as all-rounders because they only bowl when they are batting well. So that's more of a psychological thing. His argument was that to be an all-rounder, you have to be more or less equal in both skill sets. But the other analyst argued that he classified all-rounders as players who you could trust with bowling at least five overs. It is, of course, subjective. How do you view it with these players? So the original theory of all-rounders is you had to be good enough to get into the team as a batter or a bowler, which is about, if you look at Test cricket, is what, maybe eight people in the history of the game? Like, Sean Pollock is an unquestionably great all-rounder, And I don't think he would ever have got in the top six or seven as a specialist batter. Well, top six as a specialist batter, right? Would Flintoff have been in the top six? Would both of them have been in the top six? You know, maybe both of them would have. I think you make an argument for both of them. I don't know if you can with Flintoff. Would Ben Stokes have been a specialist bowler? Does he have the skill to be a specialist bowler? Yes. Would he have been a specialist bowler? Probably not. I don't think they would have picked him. I think that there are some of us who think that that is actually what an all-rounder means. And then you have a sort of what we would call the secondary all-rounder option, Ajit, which is someone who is a specialist in one and then is around par or maybe a slight negative in the second skill. So at that stage, you know, I'm trying to think of someone, that sort of Scott Styris kind of bowler, who as a fifth bowler is not like the worst fifth bowler you could have in the world. He's probably not a massive plus as a fifth bowler, but he can do the job, but he's in this. He wouldn't be, you would never pick him to bowl if he couldn't bat, right? You then have probably the worst kind of all-rounder, which is the one who generally isn't good enough to be in the side as a batter or as a bowler. That becomes the bits and pieces player. Quite often those players develop late and become a specialist, at least in one of those skills. But in the early part of their life, they don't have the skills for either. And they get picked because they're all-rounders and they're really helpful for the team. And we end up, you know, sort of mocking them. Have a look at Mitch Marsh's early career and how he went about it. Those are the three main parts. And then you have the fourth one, which I think is actually what most all-rounders are, which is a player who is a specialist who can occasionally give you something extra with their secondary skill. So Mark Waugh, Darren Lehman, Paul Collingwood, you could throw someone like Sachin or Sourav Ganguly in there. Trying to think of some other players that would be in that sort of... Nathan Astle, I've already had a question about Nathan Astle, Craig McMillan, those kinds of guys, right? If you're not an all-rounder, if you can bowl, let's say it's one-day cricket, and who do you mention here? So Brad Hodge is not an all-rounder, right? I don't think, you know, Brad Hodge was not the worst part-time off-spinner. You know, he could certainly bowl a little bit, but let's have a look here. He played, my God, he played a lot of games. He played about 900 professional games and, I don't know, took less than 200 wickets, right? He's not an all-rounder. Now, in first-class cricket, he takes 74 wickets of 41. So in first-class cricket, probably bowls less than Joe Root, but has a kind of similar kind of bowling average, maybe slightly lower. List A cricket can get you five overs on a good day. I don't know about the psychological thing that the other analyst was talking about. That's not how these things work. But anyway, and then in T20 cricket, actually bowled quite well, if you have a look at this. Again, used sparingly. That's not an all-rounder. Brad Hodge would not consider himself an all-rounder. He is a batter who can give you a little bit of bowling. Probably the vast majority of the times that Brad Hodge is bowling, it's either when nothing is happening in the game and you just have to throw the ball to someone, or the ball is spinning and it's in favorable conditions to him. I think in those positions, if that's what you are, you're not an all-rounder. An all-rounder would need to be someone who is good enough to bat in the top seven and also be good enough to at least be the fifth bowler in a side. None of the guys you just mentioned before, maybe Collingwood at his best might have been one. I'd have to go back and look at his numbers. Maybe Collingwood, but I wouldn't have thought the other guys would have been. But Paul Collingwood, I would have thought, would have played as the fifth bowler. Whereas even if Hodge was bowling for Australia, or Dilshan was bowling for Sri Lanka, it would have been in games when they needed to be the third spinner or the second spinner because the selection was wrong, or the fourth spinner because it was turning sideways. So you're not really looking all around it. It's the same if you're looking at a bowler, right? So if you're looking at a bowler like Vernon Philander or Paul Rifle, both very, very handy with the bat, right? So you can put Mitchell Starc in this as well, right? If you want a more modern version. But let me just look up Rifle's record. Paul Rifle, actually, these records are really good in Test cricket. But Paul Rifle, weirdly, in ODI cricket, is averaging 14 with the bat, right? And in List A cricket, it's about the same. Weirdly, he was a hard hitter. So if you look at his overall international numbers, he's probably averaging about 20, right? I don't think you'd be confident with Paul Rifle with his, and he could bat, right? I don't think you would be confident with Paul Rifle batting at number 7 in Test cricket. So what you're looking at there is a bowler who can bat a little bit. You put Shane Warne in there, as I said. You put Mitchell Stark in there, Mitchell Johnson, Anil Kumble, Malcolm Marshall. Lots of these sorts of guys, right? That is a huge extra skill to have, and it makes your team much stronger. They're not all-rounders, because you wouldn't want to go into a game with anyone I've just mentioned as your number 7. So you don't have the ability to pick an extra bowler in your side because you have them. Whereas Jadeja actually allows you to pick another bowler in your side because of his batting. That's an all-rounder. If you get to, and I'd have to go through, let's say Dilshan or Collingwood. If they got to a point where they could bowl, like, let's say on average 7 overs a game, I think you can argue that they are, at that point, a genuine fifth bowler in ODI cricket. And then, but you might still need like a 5.5 or a sixth bowler around to help them out on the days where it doesn't particularly work for them, right? But if that's the case, then you don't need to, you're transforming your team a little bit, right? So that it is a complicated thing, but the greatest all-rounders basically allow you to have 7 frontline batters and 5 frontline bowlers. That's really, I think, what an all-rounder is, and everything else is a variant or an offshoot of that. Adidian said, "Why is right-hander taught to run with the bat in their left hand?" Don't know. I don't think I was. I think I ran with it in my right hand. I'm trying to think now. Yeah, I can't think of a reason why. I that's not something I've ever tried to do with coaching. So if it is, it's something I've missed. Satchmo says, "Would the Test team of 2000s beat the Test team of the 1980s? McGrath, Warne, Steyn, Pollock, and Murali is a formidable quintet, but so is Marshall, Hadley, Imran, Garner, and Abdul Qadir. Two of them could also bat. The vulnerability of the 80s side would be the spinning track." Yeah. Yeah, I think the 2000s feels better. I'm trying to think of what the 80s team would be, but I think the 2000s feels better just off the top of my head, because you still have a lot of great bowling, but you also have like we didn't put Sachin in the side, right? Mainly that was because of Varun. But let's say you move Sachin or Lara to 5 in that side. You've got deeper batting because you've got Gilchrist at 6 or 7. You don't have the who's the best wicketkeeper of the 80s? Is it Dujon? Unless I'm missing someone else. It's a big difference there. So I just think that the 2000s team probably has a couple of big upgrades over it. I think that you've got Imran, Hadley. So you've got depth in your batting, and you've got Marshall, as we just mentioned. Yeah, I think... Without going through the full side, I believe the 2000 side sounds better off the top of my head. Cam says, "How are you feeling about the demolition of the Gabba after the 2032 Olympics and the construction of a new stadium for cricket and AFL at Victoria Park?" I love the Gabba area. I very rarely stay in the rest of Brisbane, so I usually stay somewhere around there. It was the Pineapple Hotel. There's another pub that I really like around there. A couple of restaurants that I enjoy. So I kind of like that. I used to have a family friend who lived around there and everything. So from that perspective, I think I'll miss it that way. I hated the Gabba from the first time I ever went. If you go back and read Australian Autopsy, I was really disappointed because I think I loved the pitch at the Gabba and I was like, I can't wait to get there. And then I got there and I was like, oh, I don't like this at all. I'm not going to miss the stadium. The history is incredible. And it used to have one of the best pitches in the world. I don't think it really does anymore. Although the pitch is still fine, but I don't think the pitch is still, at that elite level that it used to be. It's a part of cricket history that's going to go. So from that perspective, I suppose it's sad. But I think when they redid the Gabba, they just got it wrong. It just wasn't a good place to watch. I've watched cricket there as a punter. And I've watched that, and I've walked around it as a media person. Just never thought it was a very good stadium. And eventually, especially in Australia where the fans get such great treatment compared to everywhere else, think you just need to expect better. It's what happened to the Wacker as well, right? Both of those stadiums are really poor, and you compare that to the other stadiums, and there's light years difference. Anil said, cricket media has a lot of fun discussing older era players who would do well today, like talking about their true strike rates and everything. Yeah, Anil, so many people do that. It's literally just our channel, but yeah. But who's a current era player who would do better in an older era when there wasn't as much variation, depth in bowling attacks, or batters not accessing the whole 360? So I think the big change, Anil, would be anyone who is a left-arm bowler would absolutely have ripped cricket's arsehole open before Wasim Akram was around. So any left-armers, Ashdeep Singh going back, even if he bowled at the same paces as people of that time, you know, with his ability to swing the ball both ways would have just destroyed old cricket, for instance. And you could throw anyone in there, David Payne, right? Like Jason Berendorf, all those guys would have just gone back and just dominated cricket because there weren't left-arm bowlers who were reasonably fast, who were skillful. You either had very skillful left-arm bowlers who bowled very slow, or you had left-arm bowlers who maybe were a little bit quicker but were wayward and didn't have the ability. So all left-arm bowlers. The other one I would say is that anyone who is really good against right-hand batters, right? We have, over the years, got more and more left-handed batters in, so much so that we now have people like, you know, Broad and Ashwin and Kemar Roach who are specialists against left-handers. You never had to be that before. So any of those guys going back in history wouldn't work, but there's lots of bowlers and I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there's lots of bowlers in modern cricket who are just so much better against right-handers. And if they'd gone back in a previous era, would have just dominated against the era where everyone was right-handed. So those are the obvious ones that I could think of. Hurt says, Saqib for Sunrisers looks like a made for IPO with all the mad skills required. Waiting refinement. Did he catch your eye? Any other project players? From the first over, I think Hinge took the wickets and I was like, okay, he's fine. And then Saqib came on and I was like, who's this guy? Him and Prince Yadav are two guys that I've been noticing that they have. One thing I've started to look at now is the sort of multi-skill bowlers. When you have the ability to bowl with the new ball, maybe even with the middle ball, and then with the older ball, with the field in, with the field out, with people trying to whack you, you know, all these different things. And Saqib looks like that kind of guy, and he did in the first game. Without going at my notes, I would say that I've been pretty positive about him almost every time. James says, you talked about substitutions in tests, but wouldn't that increase the inequality between the big three and the small teams? The big teams might have 5 to 10 test class bowlers that they can swap between. Yeah. I mean, James, when it comes down to it, nothing's stopping the inequality. I mean, you might be right. Lots of people have brought this up before. You do sometimes get with smaller teams, though, where they have overlaps in positions as well. So they might all, you know, in Bangladesh, you might end up with like your four best bowlers might all be left arm finger spinners, right? And so having the ability, if one of them is not at their best, to bring in your second best bowler who wasn't in your 11 would also help you. But yeah, nothing stopping inequality, man. I mean, it's, yeah, absolutely nothing. Substitutions is not going to change. Not having substitutions isn't going to make it better for other teams. Alex says, how would you get Roo into the England batting lineup? I just think they need to, I mean, I'm just trying to have a look. I think I was writing about him the other day. I was looking him up the other day. I just think in Roo's case, there's no reason to bring him in and do anything silly straight away from a test position. I think if you can bring him into the lineup and try him in limited overs cricket, like the more modern traditional way of doing these things, is probably how I would look at it. Just make sure that he is comfortable and gets a few games. I'm just having a look exactly where he bats in first class cricket before I make my last statement. But yeah, I think bring him into white ball cricket. He's got a good white ball record. I'm not sure if he's one of their kind of players. I think the issue is, he's probably a down the order player. So I think it's not particularly easy to fit everyone into that side at the moment. So they're going to have the same problem with him that they've had with lots of other players. I think, you know, Ollie Pope being maybe the prime example of that. Abe says, I'm sure you've answered this before. But there's been a lot of talk about the IPL has been great for developing young players and given the exposure of elite environments and pressure. Do you think the model breaks down at a certain point, though? For example, are there certain kinds of young players or white ball skills that actively set back? I think there are. There's a lot of cricket. India's a really young society, and people are pushing through these younger players, which makes 100% of sense, and some of them are doing it incredibly. But most players, most fast bowlers are going to be at their best around 22 or 23, or starting to hit their best around 22, 23, and most batters are going to be at their best around 27, 28. And so there's a lot of really talented players, like Gaikwad's not the one I meant, Devdutt Padukal, who, like, when they're young, or Riyan Parag, when they're young, are going to fail, and people are just going to have this mindset of them that they're not very good. And so if you're like Sky and you do it in such a way that no one notices, right, and then you come back at 30, you're like a revelation. But if you're a guy who is played like Riyan, let's say Riyan Parag plays one more, he finishes this season, he's bad, he has two more decent seasons, right, and he gets close to his prime. By the time he does that, so many people already have their mindset on these guys, right? And I think that realistically, if you look at the history of cricket, the vast majority of cricketers are going to hit their peak, you know, at a certain age curve. If you're throwing everyone in young, you're giving them experience, you're giving them exposure, you're giving them professional, but they're also getting all the abuse and everything when they're not ready to deal with any of that stuff. Ali says, what are some of the batting and bowling skills that would become redundant in the next 20 years? I'm not sure anything's going to become redundant, Ali. It's a good question. I'm not sure anything's going to become redundant. I think what happens in the next 20 or 30 years is, some of this depends on what happens with the other formats. Like, the ability to get off strike, I think, is always going to be helpful, even in T20 cricket, because if Sunil Narine or Bumrah's on one, you still have to get off strike, right? So I think you could argue like something like that is the case. I just think things will go in cycles, and I think we've always seen that, right? Like, we went for a period where swing was the dominant and then seam has taken over. And now it's like, maybe we need to have the ball swinging in both directions again. So I think there will be cycles. If you look at actually what's been happening, Ali, a lot of the older skills have come back, like the leg cutter. So there might be things that lay dormant, but I don't think anything, I think the vast majority of stuff in cricket that used to happen still has come back at one stage or another and been helpful. Ajit says, after the Delhi Punjab game, Ashwin on his podcast said the DC coaching staff had as much of a part to play as in the loss as their players. His point was, once the KL had to come off the field, why not just bring in Abhishek Parel as the substitute keeper? Because then you still have Stubbs in the outfield, where you could argue was the best fielder on that side. And then you wouldn't have had Curran Nair. Yeah, I think they didn't want KL Rahul to go out, by the way. They sent the physio out. I don't know if Ash saw this, but they sent the physio out and he just said no. So sometimes your star player gets what they want, and I don't know who has the final say on that, but he clearly wanted to keep. I'm with you, though. I don't think he should have been keeping in that game, if my memory is correct of that game. Is that the game? Wait, which game was that? Yeah, the Punjab game. I think that's the one I'm talking about, yeah. Adidian says, how much of Rob's rants about teams not working on fielding is seriously true? I think him and Robbie have talked about this quite a lot. And I would agree with both of them. I don't think the current systems as they are set up are best help to make fielders good at fielding. I think they're set up because they tick boxes for fielding coaches. It's not having a go at fielding coaches. I think it's more the whole system. Using the rubber bats, you know, the way things happen, I think there are better ways of preparing players. I've always said this about caught and bowled, that caught and bowled is quite a common dismissal, and it's so rare to see anyone prepare for it. A wicket keeper's having to run back and catch the ball over their head, quite a common dismissal, and it's so rare to see people do it. And so I do believe all the way through there are much better ways of preparing fielders, and I think that Rob goes too far because he'd like to have fun with it. But I do think me and Robbie kind of do agree with some of that as well. No super chats. Just Jessica just dropping a bomb. Well, thank you very much, Jessica, for that. I have nothing to say. Jessica's a legend, and she's from the northern suburbs of Melbourne. And this is just how we roll. Big thanks to everyone. I saw there was a bunch of comments in there as well. Sorry, I can't go through them today. I've got to pop off and do something else. But big thanks to everyone again for all their support. We have a watch-along coming up very soon, so you should watch along. There's always something happening at Combox. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv.
If you make a lot of content like me, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.